The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Wolf, presiding in town session.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Eric Scott, appellant versus the State of South Dakota Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Paul Pites, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the Appellee State of South Dakota, we have Mr. Paul Sluglin, an assistant attorney general. Mr. Pites, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
And it's Pete's.
Okay, duly noted.
Last year you said you had a 50-50 shot.
Well, I know, and if you come up here more often, then I'll be less likely to blow it. So
it has been 4 years.
Don't come back.
The case of Derek Scott that's before us today presents not only a question of a right to a fair trial, an equal protection question, but also a matter of the public's trust in the jury system itself, and that it's not racially motivated. One thing that I wanted to first touch on was the standard of review in this case, and although there's been numerous cases that have stated that it's a factual finding and therefore it's clearly erroneous, this is a somewhat unique situation in the fact that Judge Eklund was not the judge that was the trial court judge in this case. Going through the past cases and then pulled basically from Pacific Reporter, U.S. Supreme Court, all of them have indicated that the reason that the trial court is afforded the deference that they are is because they have the chance to hear witnesses at the time that things are happening. That's not the case that we have here. Additionally,
they're also fact finders and we're not.
That's correct. And as I stated in my brief, Judge Eklund really sat in no different position than you folks do. In fact, in looking at the factual findings that Judge Eklund signed, I don't disagree with 1 through 5, 7, 8, or 9. The only one that I disagree with was 6, which was the basic statement of it being not pretextual, which is more of a ruling by the court more than anything else. Looking at the conclusions of law, I didn't have any objection to 10, 11, and 12. The only one that I did have an objection to was obviously 13, which again goes to there was no pretext involved. There really isn't much for a factual dispute in this case. And there's been obviously numerous cases in dealing with suppression issues that have indicated that when a constitutional right is implicated, that portion of the legal ruling is reviewed de novo. Credibility is obviously an important thing in this kind of review. In 2011, the United States Supreme Court, district court dealt with credibility determinations being made and stated, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, that deference is necessary because a reviewing court analyzes only the transcripts from voir dire. They're not as well positioned. Well, in this case, Judge Eklund only had that opportunity. We'll get into the second point as far as taking new evidence here in a bit. Following... I guess I really just can't hit that point enough, that's why that deference is given to the court, and that's why the clearly erroneous standard really sits and applies. But it goes beyond that, in that when we have a case here where we're talking about the prosecutor's credibility being a question, the juror's demeanor eventually becoming an issue, and I want to be very clear about that the state's original statement was not anything to do with inattentiveness. That didn't come up until the remand hearing. Their statement was basically, I just didn't get a good feeling from her response. And then, of course, the issue with being previously charged with a crime in Pennington County. So, of course, Judge Eklund didn't have the opportunity to observe the jurors, decide whether or not the four white jurors that were not questioned at all, that never answered any questions, whether they were also inattentive, or whether...
Is there anything that Judge Eklund could have done to remedy your concerns?
As to the jurors?
Well, you're saying that he didn't get to see the way he conducted his hearing. He did not get to the fact finder's advantage of seeing people making credibility decisions. I'm asking you, did he make a mistake? Is there anything he should have done differently? Or was there nothing he could do?
I would be of the opinion, as far as viewing the people, that there's really nothing that he can do. And that was the argument, the first issue, that he's really not in a position to be able to really do anything here. I believe there was one case where the judge that did the strikes was actually not the judge that had sat during the trial, except that happened the day after. So any opportunity to observe the jurors and so forth was still available for that judge at that time. This is not the case. We've got, you know, a situation where it's, you know, 14 months later, 12 months later. And obviously I'm not faulting Judge Eklund for that. I'm just saying that he's not in a position where he really has any ability to rule on that kind of credibility. And since Judge Thorsonson made no findings to that, we can't afford any deference, because there's nothing in the record to assume that Judge Thorsonson found that reason credible or not at the time that was made.
So what's our remedy then? What are you asking us to do? Should there just be a new trial?
I believe it should be a new trial. Basically, the failing at the trial court level with this particular issue, ruling that it was based on pattern, just really curtailed any kind of factual finding beyond that point.
Mr. Peets, is it really subjective as to what the judge thought, or is it objective, particularly as to criminal charges or criminal... I think there was an arrest that the officer knew about. Is that an objective standard and something that he could have found? I mean, that the officer said there was something about criminal activity. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. But
I believe, and I'm going to be pretty much paraphrasing too, but I believe the statement was that he had believed that she had either been charged or investigated with a threatening phone call charge. That was the statement before Judge Thorsonson at the time of the challenge.
But then Judge Eklund verified that.
That's correct.
At the second hearing.
That is correct.
So does that make a difference?
Well, yes and no. I mean, obviously, the third stage is obviously to see whether or not the state's reason was pretextual or not. And simply showing that, yes, that was a true statement, doesn't get past the area of pretext. Going back to a suppression issue prior to, I believe it was State v. Wren, where they said you can pull them over for anything. You know, if you pull them over for 2 miles an hour over the speed limit, even if that wasn't your purpose, we're not going to worry about pretext anymore. Well, the obvious thing is that pretext is not just a false statement. It's something that could legitimately be true. So simply proving that was an accurate statement isn't really the case, especially when you don't go into the next portion of the analysis, which is the part that Judge Eklund didn't do. And basically his memorandum decision is really the clearest on that. He didn't look at any of the evidence that was presented as far as that being a pretextual decision by the defendants. And primarily the biggest portion of that was, we're concerned with somebody who they believe, and I'm talking about at the time of the challenge, may have been investigated or charged with a crime, as opposed to a white juror that was impaneled that said, marked on their jury questionnaire, I've been convicted of a crime. The question then becomes, if that's the case, and this juror worried them so much because she had basically had a good experience with the criminal system and it being dismissed, as opposed to somebody that had been convicted of something, with no questions to either one of them about why that bias occurred or what that bias would mean towards the state, that's the portion of the analysis that he didn't get to. Simply proving that the reason, you know, exists in some kind of factual basis is not really the end of the analysis. But that's basically step two.
But you had an opportunity to explore that this is the third step, and at the third step you had the burden, and if you wanted to present that kind of evidence, that was your opportunity. You didn't do it.
Well, and that's because Judge Thorstensen had ruled that it was a pattern, and that was basically the end of the discussion as far as that went. And I understand what you're saying, that we could have gone into that, but the ruling would have been the same from her perspective. It was an erroneous view, but that was the basis for her ruling. We did address that at the remand, and we didn't present anything new that the court didn't already have available to them at the time of the hearing itself. And the interesting thing about that is that despite us raising those issues, the actual prosecutor in this case didn't give up any reasons why he was treating Russell Brown differently than Juror LaRoche. He didn't give any reasons as to why four jurors that didn't say anything that were white were considered to be attentive, even though they never answered any questions, and yet Juror LaRoche was inattentive. In fact, he never even gave Judge Thorstensen the opportunity to make a finding on that because he didn't actually give that reason. It was just a feeling based on her answer. Had he said she was inattentive, Judge Thorstensen possibly could have made a finding to say, I witnessed this juror, she didn't seem to be inattentive, or I witnessed this juror, she did seem to be attentive. Further, the record supports that she was. The one question that the prosecutor asked her, he didn't need to repeat it, he didn't need to recall her name. She understood and answered the question without any problems. So there's just...
We aren't really looking at who may be a good or a better juror. We're just looking with a Batson challenge, is there a reason other than race-based for the decision? Isn't that correct?
Well, Batson said something to the extent of, there was a statement in it that says, solely based on race. However, any time that there was whenever there's a factually neutral excuse on the second step, we wouldn't even need to proceed to the third step because obviously that's factually neutral. And the state's reason in this was racially neutral. There wasn't anything on its face that was inherently discriminatory. It was very vague. It wasn't specifics that I believe Batson and its progeny requires. But a pretext is just that. It's a pretext. It's a reason that I'm giving to cover up the reason that I'm doing this. And when the court decided Batson, the purpose that they were trying to accomplish was to fix the incredible burden that they put on the defendant to even prove the case in the first place that they had under Swain. They came up with this new way of doing it without a lot of really direction on where it was supposed to go and how we were supposed to determine what or was not a pretext. And that's why I particularly found State v. Cannon useful and helpful, as well as State v. Ferris, State v. Cantu, all of which were Utah cases, because what they basically did was they took all of the things that the courts have looked at before, comparison, whether or not the prosecutor questioned them, whether it had anything to do with the case that was at bar, and they pretty much took all those things and they distilled it into five factors that they would look for to determine credibility of the prosecutor. And not one of those was, can the prosecutor prove that his reason is true? It's all looking about whether or not there's a pretext, because obviously it's our burden, not the prosecutor's. But
are you saying that's irrelevant? Because, I mean, that goes to the very heart of pretext. If the officer if the attorney can prove that his stated justification was true, that goes directly to the question of pretext. It refutes pretext. So how can you argue that that shouldn't be considered?
Because pretext in and of itself is a statement that sounds reasonable, sounds to be true, but is actually masking something else. And that's really what the third step is for. Justice Zinter, if all it was we'd have to prove that this is true, we wouldn't really get past the second step. Batson talked about the fact that the jury selection process and the peremptory challenges allow someone to discriminate if they're of the mind to do so. And the reason that we look beyond that is we say, okay, we have a feeling it's undescribed. We're going to push that away because it really, there's no basis with it in the record or anything beyond that. It's not specific. But going to the crime thing, if the state is concerned about someone being charged with a crime, they're not even absolutely sure if she was charged or if she was investigated at the time of the challenge. Why would they not be concerned about a white juror that's got a conviction? It seems unlikely that their reasoning to say that this was the reason that we struck this juror is pretextual. Whether or not they can show that she's been charged with a crime, what they can't and have never responded to, and I'm talking about Mr. Hieronymus, not the state's brief, is that this was the reason that we actually struck her. It would make sense, and all of the comparison cases talk about it. Can the prosecutor have an explanation as to why he treated this juror differently than this juror when they're similarly situated? And in this case, the white juror is worse situated because he actually has a conviction. So we know that he's had an experience with the criminal system. We know that it did not turn out positively for him, even though he may have felt he was treated fairly. And that's another issue. A lot of these issues in this case could have been solved by questioning these people about their potential biases. And that was the number one condition in Ferris and in State v. Cannon. Is the alleged group bias shown to be shared by this juror? None of the state's questions that they asked them in any way raised any kind of inference that this person was somehow against the state. A simple question of, has anybody ever been charged with a crime? Had she not responded, the state's logical reason would have been, well, she didn't tell the truth. Russell Brown says, yeah, I was charged with a crime, then they're obviously different. But they didn't explore any of that because, and quite frankly, why would you? If you're going to use that as your excuse, why do you want to explore that and have the chance for the judge to rehabilitate the juror? Anything to that effect?
Mr. Peach, your time is dwindling. Dwindling, and I would like to hear on this, your comments on the second issue of whether or not new evidence could be taken.
I actually found more help in the cases that have been decided since Scott in that issue, particularly Justice Wilbur's case, and I believe that was State v. Piper, if I'm remembering that correctly. Basically saying that there's basically two ends of the spectrum. There's an affirmance or there's a remand. In between, there's that limited remand where the court is to specifically follow the examples of the or the directions of the Supreme Court. And there was some jurisdictional issues, and it was very finely worded and so forth, but I'm not going to read the whole thing back to you. There was also another case with Humble v. Wyatt. Now, none of these had to deal with this particular issue, but what they did deal with was remands and what the Supreme Court was telling the courts below them that they could do or could not do. And in Humble v. Wyatt, they were very specific to say, I believe that was one with Judge Bastian. He had retired. Additional evidence may be considered in the discretion of the court if a different circuit court judge hears the case. If the retired Judge Bastian hears the matter, further proceedings should be confined to that. The court gave no direction to say new evidence should be taken. I believe the direction that the court gave was basically to, if I can find it, I hate to misquote. For some reason I don't have that, but I swore I did. Anyway, it was basically to remand for findings consistent with the third prong, which had not been performed by Judge Thorstenson. It said if insufficient evidence exists, which to me means is already in existence. The state had rested their case. It was a two-day trial. They had ample time to provide any proof that they wanted to Judge Thorstenson. They didn't do that. And now we see this is the problem. Now Mr. Hieronymus, 14 months later, 12 months later, whatever it was at the remand hearing, says, oh, yeah, I remember that juror. She wasn't attentive. We have a whole new reason, suddenly, that never existed at the time that Judge Thorsten was there. And that was really what the evidence was, other than him showing that she had a prior charge of the paperwork for it. And since none of that was available to Judge Thorsten, I think it's inappropriate to consider it later. We don't get the second bite of an apple in a civil trial. We don't get the second bite of an apple in a criminal trial.
But you introduced new evidence yourself.
What evidence would that be?
Well, as I understand the briefs, you introduced new evidence at the remand hearing.
The only evidence that I introduced was the juror questionnaires, which the court indicated they didn't have in the file, which originally were in the file, but when I was with the public defender's office, and I was with them when I tried this case, we were required to destroy those after a certain period of time for privacy reasons, obviously. So I didn't actually give the court new evidence that they hadn't seen before. I was resupplying them with evidence that they had at the time of the trial.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Mr. Swedlund, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court,
counsel.
The question in this case is whether a Native American woman, whom I'll refer to as TL, was improperly struck from Derek Scott's jury panel because of her race. This question might best be answered with another question, which is, what rational prosecutor would leave any person of any race on his jury whom he had recently charged with criminal conduct? No rational prosecutor would do this. In this respect, TL was unlike any other juror, some of whom did have prior criminal convictions. She was the only panel member who had recently had charges filed against her by the very prosecutor standing before her. This fact alone is a compelling, race-neutral justification for peremptorily striking TL. Now, this court has seen the photos of Derek Scott, bare-chested, baggy shorts, handcuffed, and smeared with Fidemestes blood. So should the prosecutor have risked a hung jury, risked putting Derek Scott back out on the street by seating a juror who might retaliate against him for having recently filed charges against her? The prosecutor could not realistically take that risk. Striking TL was imperative to the administration of justice in Derek Scott's case. So with the proof adduced on remand that this prosecutor had, in fact, recently charged TL with a crime, Judge Eklund's finding of no purposeful discrimination is not clearly erroneous. Unless the court has any further questions from the state would rest its case on that fact.
Well, I have a question about whether or not Judge Eklund should have taken additional evidence or just, I think we sent it back, and I don't have the case in front of me, we sent it back saying, if you can make a determination, do it, otherwise have a new trial. Was it appropriate to take additional evidence?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. This court asked Judge Eklund to make specific findings. Now, as this court observed in the original Scott 1 decision, the original criminal court, quote, never reached the third step, end quote. Therefore, there was no record down below on the third step of the Batson analysis. So the remand court, therefore, had to develop the evidence as needed to address the third step. Also, the fact that the Scott 1 decision in footnote 3 cited 9 cases, 7 of which the court did take or was directly ordered to take further evidence pertinent to the third step analysis. That suggests that this court did expect Judge Eklund to develop the record further, which with whatever evidence was relevant to the third step analysis.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Swetman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Peets, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, considering the extremely short argument by the state, I'm going to have a lot of time for questions, I'm guessing. Basically, the state wants to rest their argument on the fact that what reasonable prosecutor would leave someone on the panel who they'd recently charged with a crime. But if you read the remand hearing transcript, you'll see that Mr. Hieronymus said that he didn't know that he was the person that had charged it out at the time of the challenge, and this is exactly why the problem of evidence, putting new evidence in. It expands and it becomes something that it wasn't at the time of the challenge. And that's exactly the problem. What rational prosecutor...
Couldn't a judge, but couldn't, if Judge Thorstensen had gone to the third stage, couldn't she have asked the prosecutor, you're making this allegation, what do you have to back it up? And force the prosecutor to go get the criminal records that he alleged that he had.
She could have.
So if she could do it, why can't the judge on remand do the same thing? That's what we're sending them back to do, is to seemingly to go ahead and conduct the third stage of the hearing.
Well, my reading of the Supreme Court's directive was different. It said to conduct the third stage of the hearing, which is my burden, not the state's. It also indicated that whatever evidence, if there's evidence that exists, but, I mean, this is the practical difficulty that the Supreme Court warned about when it sent it back, is that we have a new judge, we have a severe passage of time. This is the problem that we have. And the state's absolutely right. They're saying, well, we don't have any record from Judge Thorstensen because she never got to the third step. That's been my point the whole time. That third step should have been reached at the time of trial. Because
it
wasn't.
Was doomed, then what you're really saying is that the case was doomed. We shouldn't have remanded in the first place because there was no way to salvage it.
I don't believe there was. All of the factors that are talked about throughout the cases, comparability, the state pointed out in their brief, well, it's unfair to compare jurors 12 months later. You're right, we should have compared them right at the time of the challenge.
So really, you're arguing Scott 1. You're arguing that we erred in Scott 1 and we should remedy it in Scott 2.
No, I think there was sufficient precedent for this court to at least send it back. However, when I read that decision, I was like, what is he going to base that decision on? There's been nothing. There's been absolutely nothing. And that was my initial argument to Judge Eklund, is that he just really cannot sit in that position because he's really in no different position than an appellate court. But even with the evidence that he took in, all it did was show that the state's original statement was correct. And I urge the court to remember that the prosecutor did not know that he was the one that charged out the case. He further indicated at the remand hearing that he'd never been in the same courtroom with Ms. LaRoche, so they'd never seen each other. Ms. LaRoche was asked the same question that all the other jurors were asked, do you know Mr. Hieronymus? And she didn't answer. So the idea that she somehow had some kind of bias, when there's no indication in the record to indicate that, and the fact is, the prosecutor could ask that very easily. Ms. LaRoche, have you been charged with a crime? Because I seem to remember your name. Why am I doing that? That might be an uncomfortable question, but that's part of voir dire. We ask uncomfortable questions. The very first time that I made a Batson challenge, I was overruled by the judge because they said, well, you didn't put anything in the record to indicate that they're actually a minority. And I was like, well, he looks Native American. He's got a Native American last name. I believe it was French. It wasn't something, you know, LaCroix, something to that effect. Rubidoux, Bordeaux. It wasn't something like runs with a knife or anything like that. And that was a learning experience for me because I had made a decision based off of what I'd seen rather than what I knew. And that's how insidious discrimination can actually be. And that's the issue here. Did he strike this juror because she'd been charged with a crime? I have difficulty believing that when he left another juror on there that had been convicted of a crime. We don't know if Mr. Hieronymus was the one that charged out the other person. We don't know what he was charged with. We don't know if it was domestic abuse. We don't know any of those things because he didn't care to know for a white juror. And that's really what the pretext is all about. If the court doesn't have any additional questions for me, I will conclude.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Peets.
Thank you all for allowing me to be here.
Good. The court will be in recess until 10 o'clock because we are also on the internet and we run on the hour. So we got done a little early on this. We'll be in recess for approximately 25 minutes until 10 o'clock.